Everything Donald Trump says, it invariably arrives wrapped in reassurances that this tweet is a fantastic tweet, very popular, or that everyone loves this line of premium neckties available exclusively at 7-Eleven. It scans as a prank. No one does a better Donald Trump imitation than Donald Trump, and his is ruthless. Another way to say this, the ambient ridiculousness that trails Donald Trump like a cloud of steak fart and pinecone air freshener scent serves to obscure and overwhelm his every action and utterance. So when Donald Trump talks about buying the Buffalo Bills on April 1st, the correct response is to laugh first and assess the idea's relative seriousness later. Donald Trump is almost never joking. Donald Trump is always serious. He is also always the joke. But Trump is indeed looking at investing in the Bills, according to an interview with the Buffalo radio station. "I know so many people in Buffalo," Trump told WBEN-FM, "and they have asked me about looking at that, and I would certainly look at it." Of course, Trump is also looking at running for governor of New York or president of the United States. He is looking at whether vaccines cause autism and looking at whether Barack Obama was born in this country. He is looking outside, seeing snow on the ground, and then looking at the dubious science behind climate change. Of course, Donald Trump isn't going to buy the Buffalo Bills. The Bills are, for all the many people Trump knows in Buffalo, all big fans, very successful people who love the show and have told him he'd do a great job as governor. Off-brand for Trump, who is more of a heavily leveraged golf empire type than a struggling NFL franchise in Western New York type. Trump is much better at pretending to be a bold billionaire in television than he is at being one here on Earth. Trump will not run for governor or president because he would lose and look laughable doing it, and also because doing things like that is hard. He will not buy all or part of the Bills because he already tried owning a football team and wound up bankrupting an entire fucking league. This is the special secret competence at the heart of the whole Trump thing. He is a noxious presence in the culture, a clown card from premium quality mortadella, and one of the most relentlessly ill-informed and ruthlessly self-caricaturing people in American public life. But even if Trump doesn't really know that many people in Buffalo, damned if the guy doesn't know his limitations. SB Nation, April 1st, 2014.
You are listening to On Further Review.
On Further Review is a conversation that uncovers the fascinating details of the most remarkable sporting events. Events you grew up watching, and maybe a couple you've never heard of before.
Join our discussion of upsets, dynasties, and how one event can be the difference between being a footnote and being a legend. This is On Further Review.
One of the things that stood out to me before we launch into all the details is that his involvement with football seems pretty new, or maybe we're used to his involvement being pretty new with some of the things in the most recent years. But fascinating to discover that's not the case.
Yeah, not at all. And I think it's important too for us as we kind of look through this to not try to view his football involvement through how I view his lens in the political life as well, too.
Right. No, I know what you mean. And just for listeners too, we really want to dive into this as far as how it relates to sports, how it relates to football, and as best as we can objectively set aside anything of, you know, political nature and stuff, and just get into the history as we look back on further review of his involvement with football here.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, in the late 1970s to the 1980s, Donald Trump was part of this group that was interested in purchasing the Baltimore Colts from Ursay. So he began kind of wining and dining Ursay, and the talks continued, I guess, off and on until 1983. Ursay and his counsel, I guess, later claimed Trump had tried this kind of pressure tactic, saying that he would buy a USFL franchise and force his way into the NFL if Ursay didn't sell him the Colts. But Ursi actually publicly turned down this offer, where he was like, not only am I going to turn this down, I'm gonna let the whole world know I am not doing this.
He's been pretty vocal, you know, even in retrospect, as far as looking back, that it was barely considered or a real brief. You know, I don't know to what extent as far as how far down the path it got for Trump's inquiry into the Colts. There definitely does seem by many, many, many accounts that he had this interest in buying the Colts, albeit kind of a flash in the pan type of thing as far as how quickly it was over.
Yeah. And even Pete Rozelle is this larger than life NFL commissioner that was around that time frame. So Rozelle testified again in that USFL lawsuit, which we'll get to later, that Trump did want to buy the Colts, but Rozelle told him, I guess, through an intermediary, that he would just be wasting his time because, you know, Ursay would not give up total control. There's no way. I guess this face-to-face meeting that Trump said occurred at the Pierre Hotel in New York. Rozelle confirmed that he met with Trump, but he denied that he discussed anything along the lines of purchasing the Baltimore Colts. This is where Trump kind of asserted that Rozelle begged Trump to get an NFL franchise, and Rozelle said, you know, that never happened.
And I think that a lot of that came out, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe a lot of that came out in that lawsuit that you're talking about, as far as like some of the testifying and stuff that went around that, as far as, you know, what took place in that meeting. We still don't know the full details. There does seem to be, you know, Rozelle's version of the story being marketably different than Trump's version of that meeting. But we know that meeting took place. We know that happened, and it was based around Trump's inquiry into NFL ownership.
Yeah, I think I was reading through Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, and he said he went to Rozelle kind of to get his opinion on it because Rozelle had, Rozelle was actually the commissioner of the AFL, the American Football League, prior to it becoming what we know of today as the AFC. So right. He was part of that merger. So I think maybe one of the reasons why Trump went to him was he saw someone that actually knew how to go ahead and merge two professional leagues into one NFL.
Someone that had done it. I mean, yeah, had both the knowledge or wherewithal, but also had actually pulled it off.
Yeah, had pulled it off and was successful doing that. So Rozelle kind of wrote the script on how to do that. So shift forward, we kind of see, even in Trump's comments to Ursay through the intermediary or through his counsel, that there was some interest in leveraging the USFL to try to either to get his own franchise in the NFL or to build the USFL into a competitive entity with the NFL and to merge the two leagues together. So let's get into this team called the New Jersey Generals.
Yeah. You know, the interest, you know, of the USFL in Trump, I think that they were trying to, you know, grab a hold of him as far as potential ownership. Very early on, they actually inquired with Trump as they're trying to put together, you know, wealthy owners to try to get this thing started up. And initially, they wound up reaching out to Trump and he turned them down. So, I mean, there was that interest initially, and rightfully so. New York being a huge market, Trump being a certified figure in New York at this time, having the money to back him. We see in so many of his endeavors, that's been a huge asset for Trump, is having that literal cachet as far as being able to step into things like this. So he was a very, very appealing potential owner for them. He turns him down right away, but you know, there's a continued history between him and them.
Donald denied and kind of walked away. He had that he made a $25,000 down payment to the USFL to obtain the New York or New Jersey franchise. And then he decided not to make the second payment when it came due in 1982, didn't follow through with that. But a little bit later, Trump eventually purchased the Generals when they went on sale from an Oklahoma businessman. So he purchased them for about $10 million.
Was what Trump wound up actually going through with. Yep. For the Generals.
And the Generals too were kind of bolstered by this running back named Herschel Walker.
Might have heard of him.
You might have heard of him. He's kind of a big deal. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He's Herschel Walker's an instrumental part in both the USFL and specifically Trump's involvement, because Walker is brought on by the Oklahoma owner, the oil man, J. Walter Duncan, that you had mentioned. So he's brought in, and in my mind, that makes it a much more enticing get for Trump. You know, the generals are kind of, all the leagues, or all the teams rather, in this new league are trying to figure out, you know, what they can pull from. Getting Walker was huge because he was also an underclassman, so they got at him before the NFL could. So they get this Heisman Trophy winning star out to this upstart league, at the same time that J. Walter Duncan's looking to get out of ownership. Trump sees this as a valuable, you know, entity now to wade into.
Yeah. And Trump also, in addition to getting Walker, he almost lands. I think he could have landed Don Shula, the legendary coach for the Dolphins, but there was a media appearance during a halftime show, of an actual Dolphins game, which Shula was coaching, that Trump talked about this, you know, possibility of getting Shula to New Jersey, and it kind of pissed Shula off. And
before anything was actually in stone, kind of jumps the gun with that halftime news. He was very aggressive with trying to get after Shula, for sure.
Yeah, and you could have had him, which would have been a really interesting kind of what if there. But Trump said that he went ahead and did the went after the New Jersey Generals for the publicity of what it meant for his name and his market. He said, "I hire a general manager to help run a billion-dollar business, and there's a squib in the papers. I hire a coach for a football team, and there are 60 and 70 reporters calling to interview me." So he saw the value of the publicity of that. And he did a couple things for the publicity too. So he calls in Lawrence Taylor, the famed New York Giants linebacker, and kind of make it seem like he was signed, and he offers him this contract. I don't think Lawrence Taylor was ever close to being signed with the New Jersey Generals. So, but it was his publicity stunt. And then he goes ahead and signs this guy out of Boston College, known for his Hail Mary over the Miami Hurricanes, named Doug Flutie from Boston College. And he hires this guy. And again, another
– yeah, college football star, right?
Yeah, a phenom. So you have Herschel Walker, a star. You have Doug Flutie, a star. And yeah, so again, these signings to kind of help bolster – I think it helps bolster the league itself, and not just his own team, but it kind of gives some respect and notoriety to the league. And because of that, he asked the league to kind of help pay the salary of Doug Flutie. Because he said, "I never expected the league to pay for it, but you know, there's two things. First off, you know, this was valuable to the league, and it never hurts to ask." He said, "I didn't expect him to actually pay for it."
Sure, worth putting out there. Yeah. And I think his argument being that, you know, here he is making a move to help bolster the league. There's not a lot of precedent for teams coming together to pay a different team's salary. But
there's also not a lot of precedent for this USFL.
Exactly. Either. The book is wide open. Right.
He's trying to do what he can for what he views as the long-term success of the league. And that's what you see. I mean – you can disagree with him as far as his tactics and some of the other owners, like I believe John Bassett, of how to run the league. But what I thought was interesting, and we can kind of walk through this too as we kind of approach the lawsuit here, is I'm shocked, and maybe I shouldn't be shocked. It might be more human nature, and I kind of make billionaire individuals larger than life. But I'm shocked at how complacent the other owners were when it comes to kind of what Trump's vision of the USFL was versus kind of what the original thought process and the original charter for the USFL.
Well, it wasn't unanimous by any means. I mean, there were these, you know, there was Trump's way of doing it, and then there was, or his vision for it, and then there was a different vision for it. Yeah.
Yeah, it just seems like they kind of succumbed to Trump's vision, and you know, reading articles and reading different books and stories on this fascinating league, they all kind of seem to, you know, not I want to say bow down, but they kind of, you know, acquiesce to Trump's demands and his vision for the league without much of a fight, really, aside from John Bassett. And so even as they start with a spring league, which I think the model for a spring league was a brilliant model.
I think it's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great idea. And I do appreciate Trump's quote of, if God wanted football to be played in the spring, he wouldn't have created baseball, which I think.
that's a good line. Yeah. That's a good line.
I might not like the guy, but that's a funny quote.
Right. Right. But I mean, they start this spring league, and I'd say there's mixed reviews. But I think for the majority of looking back at this in review, I think it had some success. Like, it had some growth in this spring league, with these owners and kind of putting out the plan started by. I believe Dixon was kind of the originator of the USFL and kind of putting these things together. One quote I really liked that kind of gives you a image into those types of ownership rooms or meetings or whatever you have comes from a fantastic book. If you want more on USFL, this crazy league written by Jeff Perlman called Football for a Buck. And he mentions in there that, I think the guy's name was Ralstein that was helping Dixon kind of go around and grab owners at the very beginning. And he mentions they were looking for people with deep pockets and large egos. And that's what kind of, to your point, that's what's kind of remarkable about, seemingly this one man, this owner from New York or New Jersey, coming in and kind of taking over the room, is that this was a room put together by men with, kind of to your point, large egos and deep pockets of themselves, as far as being a fly on the wall for some of those discussions.
But. Yeah. And I know that, again, we look at this through a different kind of lens. We look at this through, naturally, and I don't know if there's a way to kind of get around this, but we look at this through the lens of looking at Trump as our 45th president. So, and we look at the different decisions he's made and kind of question those decisions. And so we look at these and retroactively kind of question these decisions too. But it could be also that his viewpoints as far as pushing the league to fall and challenging the NFL head to head had more widespread support than people give him credit for. That this was a more of a consensus that maybe John Bassett was on the outside looking in than Trump was, just based on how the votes went down, as far as how the votes went to pursue the lawsuit or how the votes went to this different things like this. So
he definitely had more on as far as him being Trump, more on his side, obviously, to be able to push this through, to be able to put these steps in motion and. Whether you think he muscled it through on his own or agreement, like you mentioned, either way, there was enough agreement to kind of come up with this idea of challenging the NFL for the fall and specifically, with trying to obtain TV rights, if they made that move.
I think I'm guessing that a lot of the owners agreed that there was a need to challenge the NFL. There was a need for the move to fall, but maybe the tactics of how to go about doing that was where disagreement was had. And a lot of times when you have a shared consensus on an objective, but you don't have a consensus on how to achieve that objective, sometimes the largest voice in the room can kind of dictate how to get there, which you can dictate the terms then of that objective.
Right. Which definitely falls. I mean, Donald Trump had the loudest voice in that room as far as the conviction behind this type of move.
So he moves, they move to the fall, and again, a spring league. I think one of the challenges they faced was when they moved to the fall, they had a longer off season. So they had this, they ended spring football and then they had almost, what would have been like a year and a half basically of no football. And so when you're a fledgling league like that, you need momentum. You need fan support, you need momentum. You're not getting it because your jerseys are cool. So you definitely need
that's off the table. Yeah, that's not
this
happening.
This isn't because like people are like, oh man,
this isn't Oregon and their unis. No.
But you need this momentum. You have these great players, right? You have Steve Young, a phenom out of BYU, come out there and play for LA in the USFL. You have Doug Flutie.
Right. Yeah, Jim Kelly, like those things. I was just going to say on Steve Young real quick, like doing some of this research and just seeing, you know, maybe especially about the USFL. He now makes the table of the hypothetical argument. If you could have dinner with whatever type of, you know, athlete or what have you. Steve Young, for me, a kid from BYU, the only Mormon D1 school, USFL, played with Jerry Rice. Like, imagine that guy's stories. That's incredible. So that's a side note. But yeah, no, you have all these athletes for sure.
And I'm listening through this and picturing a 22-year-old Steve Young in the USFL under, I think Oldenburg was the owner, and just an eccentric guy from LA, right? Like, I legitimately, I think I feel the most bad for Steve Young in that, I'm just like, that poor kid.
Agreed. Agreed.
That poor kid. I'm sure he was, you know, he was prepared for it. He was a phenomenal athlete in his own right. So, and then, like, you know, not only does he do that, but later on he goes and he backs up this, you know, this guy named Joe Montana, No pressure, Steve.
I'll never forget the Super Bowl. What was it, against the Chargers, I think it was, where his post-game interview, he goes, is it off yet? Talking about the monkey on his back for Steve Young. But what a phenomenal career. But someone definitely with incredible stories throughout all this. And some of that lends itself, too, as far as I think the this lawsuit that we're going to dive into between USFL and the NFL is a huge component. But some of the stories and things I'm interested in when it comes to Steve Young is kind of some of the dysfunction or the stories in the USFL. Like, they had other issues as well, which I think is where the biggest question lies. And that's if this, maybe this was the right move, was it the right time?
Yeah, I think, yeah. And I agree with that a lot too. I think it was the right move. I think it was the wrong time. That's my viewpoint of it. And I'm looking at the timeline for how the AFL did it. And they took them about 10 years to go from start to merger with the NFL. So about a 10-year standpoint. And this is, what, 4 or 5 years? So this
– Yeah, three to four, yeah, somewhere.
This is pretty very, quick. This is very new. And obviously a different time frame too, versus from the 60s versus the 80s and the 80s. So different, it could be said that it's a different type of league, and that if they wanted to get to the 10-year mark, they had to get that TV deal. They had to get that market there. But I think there was other ways of doing it too. So you have this little known company in Connecticut startup, I think in 1973, 75, called ESPN. So, which is, brand new company, 24/7 sports broadcasting network. Never heard of before. Looking for something, right? So you could have gotten in with that. And then if you stayed in the spring too, I mean, who are you going to compete with? But I do think that the lawsuit was a good idea. I think it needed to be done. The AFL had a lawsuit against the NFL, so this was, you know, that kind of helped bolster and kind of bring notoriety to their thing. AFL actually lost the lawsuit. It was basically a similar lawsuit of, you know, asserting that the NFL violated the Sherman Antitrust Act. And in that case, the judge ruled that the NFL did not violate the Sherman Antitrust Act. So with the AFL, they ruled in favor of the NFL, but it kind of it gave some notoriety to the AFL, and it kind of helped that trajectory of them becoming part of the NFL.
Merger.
So the Sherman Antitrust lawsuit is a pretty common lawsuit you see. It's kind of originally made to kind of break up some of these antitrust and monopolies that occur within the U.S. Yep. So I believe, and this is kind of my theory, is that there would be no way, and I don't believe that the antitrust lawsuit, if it had went forward as the USFL had wanted it to, would have would have worked. So I think according to kind of what they were looking at, about $440 million in damages, which with the antitrust lawsuit, it's tripled. So that becomes around $1.3 billion in damages. But just based on I'm going to nerd out a little bit here. Based on case law and what we're looking at with the AFL versus NFL, back in the 1920s, there was a case with a Federal League versus National League, a baseball case. And the ruling came down that the Sherman antitrust doesn't apply to sports leagues at all, that it's primarily with commercial business.
Interesting.
Because it's dealing with interstate commerce, and you're not really, there's no commerce going on there. So that's what the judge ruled that. Hmm. So I think if it had been appealed at all, and if it had gone further than just that district level that it was there in New York, that it would have been struck down if it went higher. That if
sure.
If I know they were awarded the infamous, you know, $3.75 or the $1 award. But I think if they were awarded the full $440 million or even, you know, somewhere, you know, closer to that amount, I don't think it would have stuck, because I think the case law just, you know, there's too much case law to show that there's not a, that the Sherman Antitrust Act doesn't necessarily apply to sports, to the
sure.
NFL.
Sure. So what you're saying is the NFL could have got, like, by appeal and stuff, if they had been awarded the huge, large sum, could have probably appealed that through with success.
Yeah. I think that's part of the reason why I think, again, this has to do with the right decision, the wrong tactic. And that is, I don't think they should have approached this from a Sherman Antitrust Act, but approach this from the perspective of the TV deals, and approach it from that perspective of not necessarily going after the NFL, but maybe approach going after the TV stations, going after ABC, going after CBS, and taking them to court instead of taking the NFL to court.
Gotcha. Yeah, because the USFL had an ABC deal, right, in place for the spring. I think they wound up, there was a forfeiture or a closing of that with the move to the fall. So that might have been more, if I'm understanding what you're saying, that might have been their better lawsuit rather than the NFL. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it would have been a better lawsuit to go after those contracts like that, to go after the TV station, the network itself, and say, hey, look, why aren't you giving us a contract as well? Why are you limiting it only to the NFL? You know, you're, so I think that would have been helpful to go after them instead. But the infamous $1 award, the court, I'm reading some the case summaries of these different cases from the AFL v. NFL and then from USFL v. NFL. And the court opinion of this says regarding that $1 ruling, because Trump and the USFL We're pretty aghast at this ruling. They said it's unfair. There's no way that.
Well, because they won, like they won the lawsuit, and their damages were $1. So, like I think sometimes it gets lost the fact that they won. Like the court decided that their objection to this was valid, but they decided the $1, and yeah, that leads to some wringing of the hands.
The court ruled that any seeming inconsistencies in the jury's separate verdicts can be reconciled in a manner that belies plaintiff's insistence that a new trial is mandated because of evident jury confusion, and plaintiffs being the USFL. It may be said that the verdicts in this case are a manifestation of the jury's right to an idiosyncratic position, but that right can and should be exercised by jurors without fear that their faithful efforts will be disregarded by courts eager to impose their own version of justice. So the courts basically said, hey, look, we can't, we understand that there's this disagreement that, you know, they didn't know whether or not the $1 was appropriate for the damages awarded. But they said, hey, you know, this is what the jurors decided. And if that's what the jurors decided, we can't necessarily go back and change it just because it doesn't fit what we view as what would be just or fair. We can't impose our own version of justice there.
Not so well. And even the jurors, like they, you know, part of the reason, at least from what I've read or studied, I think by all accounts, a huge reason for that $1 mark was to avoid a hung jury in the sense of having a decision. Within that jury selection, there was a lot of debate as far as what the amount should be. Like, how do you come up with, okay, they've won this now. How do you come up with what is right and fair? And this is what kind of settles on. One of the things that stands out to me about this particular involvement for Donald Trump in football is I think he thought he had more support
He had more support. He kind of blames, and I think he's right on this too. He blames the USFL Public Affairs Office, or the kind of the communications office. After every single day in court, Pete Rozelle had his media relations guy go out there and talk about the NFL and talk about what a great day they had in court. And Trump kept asking Harry Usher, who was the USFL commissioner at the time, why aren't you out there talking to it? And the commissioner was like, well, you know, all we really have to do is convince the jurors and that's it. And Trump said, hey, I know that it's really just the jurors we have to convince, but these guys are, I know they're not supposed to go home and watch TV or read articles about it, but the profile case like this, they're definitely getting that. And that's one of the reasons too, I think, is that the NFL built that public opinion. They built that, they leveraged that in a way that Donald Trump wanted to do, but couldn't do because Harry Usher, the USFL commish, wasn't pursuing that and didn't believe in that same way too.
Yeah. One thing that's real interesting, just to get in this a little bit, I guess more, but the jurors, like, reading about some of their aftermath, whether immediately or years later, it's just crazy to me as far as the perspective or the perception, rather, with you know, Trump kind of being the face of the USFL, as he wasn't actually a plaintiff in this, but the generals were, and so he then kind of became one of the faces of the USFL's side of this discussion. And just, he kind of came off as brash and abrasive, in, you know, to the public, basically to the jurors, to the public. Whereas, like you said, Rozelle immediately after each time is doing damage control, trying to reinstate, you know, in the public's eyes, the NFL. And I think that helped them where they even lost this lawsuit, but kind of won the war, that at NFL, that is, where there wasn't anybody, you know, there was no throwing up of hands or up in arms for the fact that they only got this $3.76 damages paid out. Like, nobody thought that was egregious. There was no backlash, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And that might be like what you said, as far as the NFL playing damage control better than the USFL.
NFL, credit to them and Pete Rozelle, did an excellent job at shaping that narrative. Sure. And shaping what was, you know, what was expected, and shaping the kind of how the media outlets, which are the media outlets are already friendly to the NFL, and the whole case is that the media outlets are more friendly to the NFL versus the USFL.
Right.
And so what a bold move to basically be like in an antitrust lawsuit involving the media rights of for football, to basically be like, not only are we in violation of the Sherman antitrust and monopolizing monopolizing media, but we're going to do it right in this lawsuit.
Yeah.
And you can't stop us.
You can't stop us. Yeah. No, it's right. Yeah. The strength behind them. I mean, and for the markets that were there, I mean, you have something established, like you said earlier, you know, Rozelle's done a great job of making the NFL what it is to that point, and even moving forward, versus this upstart league. I mean, there's, yeah, incorporating that into even this lawsuit, there's no denying which side the media would, or the marketing would, like to win, and that being the NFL.
And so after this lawsuit, again, the USFL wins, and they're awarded $3.75 total in damages. And obviously, it's enough to pay. It's enough to pay the bills for the next season.
Right.
So it's not gonna pay Jim Kelly's salary. They say they made the decision. The league makes the decision to scrap the 1986 full season just because it was financially impossible without having a contract with a major television network.
Yep.
So a unanimous decision not to indefinitely suspend play occurred on August 5th, 1986. Another part about the timeline, we talk about, you know, maybe the right decision, wrong time frame, is that in 1987, the NFL's five-year contract with the networks and its collective bargain agreement with the NFL players is set to expire. And this is where you have – and it did expire, and this is where there was that strike. You had the scabs.
Yeah.
Fill-in players, and scabs being a term for those who kind of cross union lines and fill in striking union positions.
Many USFL players wind up crossing those lines to take positions when the NFL players are holding out. Yeah.
I mean, you just can't imagine the possibilities that would have occurred if they had hung out just for two extra years of not bringing the roster down for two extra years, play spring ball for a couple extra years, build that fan base up, build that notoriety up. It's a new league, so you're expected to lose money. It's kind of what there was, I think, each owner or across all 12 teams was expected to kind of invest over $100 million in capital. But man, I mean, you can't imagine, especially with how that turned out in history too, and
right.
How that kind of blew up in the NFL's face.
Right.
If you had stuck around since till that time,
that would have been the time. Yep.
That could have changed the tables. That could have totally changed the tables of that.
Right.
Because again, it goes back to the media outlets, the media contracts. The media outlets didn't want to show, fill-in players, no names
right.
on TV.
Right.
So if it could have been the media outlets coming to you, asking you for a contract to show Doug Flutie, yep. asking you for a contract to show Steve Young and the Jim Kellys
Jim
and the
Kelly.
Herschel Walkers.
Right.
I mean, these guys like that too,
right.
which have been a huge, huge game changer.
And I think it would have been interesting. Again, it's a huge what if, but it would have been interesting to see the league. I just feel like the league being the USFL in this, like the USFL being not at a place to make this type of move. And then there's always the what if of it, you know, like you said, a couple years later, having been perhaps a much more prime of an opportunity to come for the NFL or to come for fall football in general, whether it be a merger or or a supplement, not supplemental, but challenging league. Cause I don't know how you feel about it. I really, with as far as Trump and the USFL and the NFL and football here, I really feel like his goal was to merge with the NFL by making this move. I could be wrong. It just, as far as reading, you know, kind of the events and stuff surrounding it, I don't know that his end game, this is again, conjecture on my part, but I don't know that his end game was to supplant the NFL or even necessarily challenge continually in the fall, but rather to take the successful programs, the successful franchises from the USFL and incorporate them into the NFL, like AFL, NFL merger, like you said. I think that was even way back when he met with Pete Rozelle in New York in that hotel. Like, I think that was his, I see that as being his end game.
Yeah. And absolutely. I think that was his end game. And I think that was his end game even more so than, I know there people, you know, there's opinions and articles about how Trump wanted his own own NFL team. I don't necessarily think these moves were to bolster his chance of getting an NFL franchise. I think he saw the best way to get an NFL was through the entire league getting through the NFL, not necessarily just him himself, leveraging into an NFL and NFL franchise.
Right, like to swap. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. He wasn't looking to like, hey, I'm going to move from USFL ownership to NFL ownership, but rather incorporate that franchise into the NFL.
It's easy to say this in hindsight, to look at this, but this is why within decision making and really politics in general and business politics, patience is such a huge part of being a savvy and patient individual and having the ability to get things done is knowing when to act and knowing when to engage, knowing when to, when to push what buttons. And it's not, in a way, I think Trump was over, kind of in over his head when it came to sports leagues and it came to this realm. Is obviously he's a tycoon when it comes to real estate, but when it comes to the world of sports and kind of this whole thing going on here, I think he was in over his head, which when you're in over your head, you tend to act more aggressively and you kind of just go out there and throw your cards on the table just in case, as opposed to being patient and waiting for that 87 season, waiting for more things to happen. And he had some internal support. Yep. So we had this guy named Al Davis from the Oakland Raiders franchise. Al Davis's franchise was the only NFL franchise not listed on the USFL v. NFL lawsuit. And Davis actually testified on behalf for the USFL against it. And obviously, if you read Davis's history with Pete Rozelle, they had a long ongoing disagreement about lots of things. But you could have really, you had one internal support, which again, that's helpful. And you can kind of see perhaps maybe where Al Davis pressured the USFL and Trump into pursuing this lawsuit, because it would have been helpful for Davis and his lawsuits and his kind of dealings against the NFL too. This actually isn't where Donald Trump's involvement with professional football ends, surprisingly. So this ends, and I don't know if it's simultaneously as this is going on or if it's immediately after, but Trump expresses it kind of a little bit of interest in purchasing the one of the most iconic franchises in the NFL, and that's the Dallas Cowboys. He winds up not doing it, and he said a couple things. I think he kind of gets some flack for this, I think unfairly so. But he says, "I feel sorry for the guy who is going to buy the Dallas Cowboys," he told at the time. "It's a no-win situation for him, because if he wins, well, so what? They've won the years. And if he loses, which seems likely because they're having troubles, he'll be known to the world as a loser." So obviously, we look at Jerry Jones and the kind of how Jerry Jones has helped make that franchise one of the most valuable franchises in the entire world, in sports leagues in general, and especially in the NFL. But in 1984, I think that's a fair assessment to make. Trump's of the Cowboys, and Trump says of NFL brands in general, that these brands were established and you just see their value move laterally, and there's not enough to create value there. And again, for 1984, I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of NFL franchises.
The Dallas Cowboys in 84 might not have been the right move, but there's no denying, and even in Trump's eyes, that this was the NFL to be involved in that. There just seems to be like this carrot in front of him of opportunity.
So, and then it doesn't end here either. So Trump later on, I think in the late 1980s, he's considering purchasing the Patriots from Billy Sullivan, the guy who kind of started the AFL franchise. So Trump was considering it, but he backed down because there was, I guess, across the team and the stadium, there's about $104 million in debt that the team, and so he didn't want to take that on.
Yeah, the Pats were a mess during this time, and that was it. Wasn't there's an opportunity. Like I think today, there's a lot of times where you'll see a franchise across any major sport up for sale, and it's like someone's trying to move on or do something, and it's this huge bidding war. But for this in 88, this was really like somebody wanting to take over something that was. If you thought the Cowboys were not a good purchase in 84, the Pats in 88 seemingly even worse as far as a prospect. They had an article that I think we both stumbled across from the Boston Globe, where they said Trump approved the agreement that they had submitted to him. In these discussions, he was satisfied with the numbers and the deal, but the word was circulating that he wouldn't get an NFL approval. And without assurances, informal or formal, of NFL approval, he told me tonight that he could not proceed further with the deal at this time. And that's Joel Kozel from the Boston Globe around this time frame. And I think, on Trump's side of stuff, the huge and large debt being a huge factor as far as that getting approved through or worked through.
And you had different opinions too. So Art Modell said that the NFL owners would have approved Trump, even though Trump took this case against him. The Trump team kind of branded this deal. They said that they didn't, you know, they looked at the numbers, but they didn't want to be a loser. And they, you know, Trump doesn't like to lose. I said, you know, the Kozel, that same guy, says the lazy writer would say that Trump really missed out. But after he took the deal for the team, the stadium went bankrupt and was then bought later by Robert Kraft. So the stadium wound up going bankrupt. And Kozel says that there are heroes and villains in the story, and Trump really is neither a hero nor a villain. So he's kind of just an individual, a side character. So Trump goes quite a while now from what we know, and there could be deals that we don't know about or different discussions we don't know about, but it goes a long time between this interest in the 1988 Patriots to 2014 when he expresses interest in the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah, the most recent kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the article from, you know, the beginning of this episode is related to this interest in 2014. And I think it's funny about the fact that, you know, the article goes ahead and says that there's no way Trump's going to run for president or own the Bills. And he is
this type of huge move. And instead of owning the Bills, he goes on to become president.
So come on, Buffalo.
Yeah. You could have done us one. You could have done us a favor. Why is it always the Bills?
Take one for the team.
I'm still mad about those Super Bowls. Get over it. God.
You know, just make the damn field goal. So he expresses interest. And there's three different individuals that are kind of big, prominent names that want to do this. And the first one is Terry Pegula, who is the Buffalo Sabres owner. And then later, it's a guy named Bon Jovi. You know, may have heard of him a couple times before. Bon Jovi was part of this ownership team from Toronto. And I don't know if you know the geography. So Buffalo was pretty close to Toronto. You have a lot of Toronto natives who are fans of Buffalo. But a lot of the diehard Bills fans were afraid that Bon Jovi and this Toronto-based group would move the Bills to Toronto. Trump kind of capitalized on that fear, and he really didn't do a whole lot of negative press or a whole lot of involvement with Pegula. Instead, he went after Bon Jovi and kind of attacked that ownership team. He created this thing called he had individuals create for him this thing called 12 Man Thunder. He made these Bon Jovi free zones and bars across Western New York. But because of the name 12 Man Thunder, Texas A&M wound up suing.
Really? Over this, like, guys, over this over little, thing, yeah, over yeah, yeah.
Whoever, because of the 12th man. And the guy who is kind of heading this is this guy named Caputo, Michael Caputo.
Okay.
Who is, again, on, if you watch any kind of news or follow anything with today.
Yeah, name that's popped up again.
He popped up a couple times.
Yeah.
So he had put together the spokesperson for this 12th Man Thunder group was this double amputee cancer survivor. And so he changed the narrative. Again, it goes back to the point of if you want to win these days, you have to shape that narrative. You have to shape how perception is. By Jill Sargent told me, perception is reality. My perception is your reality.
Yep.
But he kind of shapes it to being that Texas A&M is threatening this double amputee cancer survivor with a lawsuit. It's all about undermining the candidacy and the viability of Bon Jovi and this Toronto-based group.
Right. It's just trying to continually, cut at that, kind of cut the legs out from it.
Yep. So Trump, again, he hired Michael Caputo. Michael Caputo is a Buffalo native. And they went through this thing called astroturfing, which is basically a way of covertly funding a supposedly grassroots group. So that's kind of what astroturfing is a terminology goes. And that's kind of what Trump is doing. And they had some lawsuits and settlement, not lawsuits, but some kind of non-disclosure agreements where Trump couldn't say the name or, you know, allude to this.
Gotcha.
Everybody kind of knows right now that Trump was definitely behind it.
Yeah. And, it's kind of come out, and we know that now, right?
But the Bon Jovi group bid about $1.2 billion for the Bills. Trump entered a bid for $1 billion, and the Pegulas, again, the Sabres owners, bid $1.4 billion.
Gotcha. So these are the offers 2014 for the Bills. Basically, Trump, Bon Jovi, and what is it, Pagulas?
Pagulas, yeah,
the Saber ownership. Okay.
Yeah. Which I think it's interesting to see how Trump isn't going after the Sabres. He's going after what really would have been the middle bid, right? Bon Jovi's bid.
Sure.
So he really isn't going after there was, and if you read articles, you look at it as for the most part, the Pagulas, it was theirs to lose.
Sure. So not so going after the main or the lead contender.
They're already in Buffalo. They have a franchise in Buffalo there already. Yep. They know the city. They understand it. They, they're the highest bid, which is, I think is fascinating. I'll explain that later exactly why I think that's the case. I don't think it has anything to do with football. But Trump told Fox News, I'll be bidding. Other people will be bidding. And I would like to think my chances are very, very unlikely that I will win. Because I'm not going to do something totally stupid, maybe just a little stupid, but not totally stupid. He didn't expect to win in this case. And typical Trump response, he sent out a series of tweets after the deal went through that Pagulas got it. And so he says, even though I refuse to pay a ridiculous price for the Buffalo Bills, I would have produced a winner. Now that won't happen. And he says, the people of Buffalo should be happy. Terry Pagula got the team, but I hope he does better with the Bills than he has with the Sabres. Good luck.
Oof, some shade.
And then later he says, NFL games are so boring now that actually I'm glad I didn't get the Bills. Boring games, too many flags, too soft. Here's my conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory Friday. If it's not Friday and you're listening to this, go listen to it Friday too. That way you can, you know,
feel the full weight of it.
So my theory is this. I don't think this had anything to do with the Buffalo Bills franchise. I think this was his preparation to run for president.
Really?
You know, a lot of people look at, you know, we see him coming down that elevator and we think that's when the start of this presidential campaign begins. Hmm. But if you understand how these presidential campaigns really start, they start a long time before you know they start.
Yeah.
There's a lot of background that goes into it. And so I think that this was kind of a way for him to kind of test out his campaign rhetoric.
Okay.
To really use a type of phobia over foreigners and stuff like that. So, and again, this is Buffalo, being afraid they're going to move it to Canada. So you have that foreign phobia going on there.
Yeah.
And the ability to have a grassroots movement. It gives him some notoriety in the press within the New York market. Again, he's thinking about running for governor or president this time.
Right.
So what better way to kind of get some free publicity out there than to throw your name in a ring for one of the most beloved New York franchises in Western New York. You know, if you're Donald Trump, you're running as a Republican ticket, you know you're not going to win New York City, right? So you're not going to go after the Jets or the Bills or something like that.
Right.
Or the Jets or the Giants.
Right.
You're not going to win New York City. So the strength of the Republican Party in New York is really in that Western New York area. So what better way to kind of get some free press than to go out and pretend like you're going to buy the Buffalo Bills?
Nice. Yeah. Okay. I see the conspiracy form in here, or the black helicopter theory type of just being maybe a foundational point, or like you said, you know, kind of testing the waters of basically vying for public opinion.
He's the individual has capitalized throughout his years. And you looked at that even back in the USFL days too, where he has capitalized on the benefits of free publicity.
Sure.
From his time of, you know, if I sign a coach, I'll get 70 to 80 reporters in my office versus signing a new general manager, even though they run an $8 billion organization, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's about the publicity there. And I see the same thing here with Trump and his bid for the Bills, especially since he's not going after the Pagulas. The fact that he's going after Bon Jovi, the fact that he's going after this Toronto group makes me think this was kind of just a way to kind of test out.
Yeah.
Campaign machinery.
Yeah, maybe not a real actual try to own, you know, the Bills, but something else.
And obviously, we have the benefit of looking this back from 2020, looking back onto 2014,
right?
As opposed to, you know, in 2014, you wouldn't have known that this guy is about to, as the SB Nation article says, there's no way this guy's going to run for governor or president.
Right. Right. No, it wasn't on anybody's mind at that point.
There was no way that they thought this was even a viable idea.
Huh. I like it. I like Conspiracy Fridays. That's good. Yeah. I mean, Trump is definitely a five-star member of the proponents of all press is good press. you know, as far as just, you can see as him trying to, you know, just establish his name, establish himself in the public eye and stuff like that. And this definitely did. I mean, this definitely kept for a brief period of time, his name, as far as seemingly seeking ownership for the Bills.
Yeah. So a fascinating look at the ways that our 45th is or was involved in the NFL.
No, it is interesting to see just the different involvements and the different, you know, connectivity between Donald Trump, now our sitting president, you know, with football, with the NFL, with these different leagues. I mean, as far as the USFL and the NFL, it's interesting to see that, you know, I always think of the what ifs, you know, the what ifs for the USFL, obviously the what ifs of, you know, maybe his intrigue into the Bills wasn't completely or 100% serious, but some of those things, you know, what type of owner he would have been.
You have such a wide variety of ownership within the NFL and the personality wise that I think it would have been a interesting hypothetical, and who knows if we'll ever see it. Who knows if, you know,
right,
what happens and what, you know, if we'll ever see that come to fruition. I think if there's one thing that we can say now is that in light of everything we've kind of gone through as a nation, everything we've seen in the last 4 years, last 6 years, is that whatever doubts you have about that guy and whatever, you know, opinions or you think, oh, that can't be, just go ahead and throw that out.
Yeah.
It's probably, yeah, he does his own thing. He writes his own script.
And right. No, it's really the case of kind of marching to the beat of your own drum type of deal where the different moves, it's like you said, you can't assume. There's no roadmap knowing where it's going and stuff for that. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So what kind of, as you kind of reflect back on this and you think through kind of this history of Donald Trump versus the NFL versus football, his involvement with it over the years, any takeaways, any kind of lessons learned, any way that you're enjoying the sport of football now as a result of kind of walking through this?
So, I mean, I did. I was greatly intrigued by the USFL. And I'll say this, one of my biggest takeaways, besides the fact that I think his aggressiveness and lack of ability to see things from perhaps somebody else's perspective of the ownership in the USFL, as far as that being a viable spring league. But one of the things I do see is a big takeaway is Trump's involvement. Even today, I think it lends a little bit of understanding to some of the things he might bring up, some of the things he might tweet, some of the things he might be interested in. That was a big takeaway for me when it comes to the NFL, when it comes to football. We haven't seen a president quite, you know, previous, quite this involved in some of the inner workings or response to things in sports, response to things in football. But I think for Trump, he definitely feels like he's always been kind of a part of this, like he's always been in the conversation. So I guess that's one thing that was a big takeaway for me is this idea of his involvement or his commenting on sport events or things that happen in sporting leagues is something that I think he perceives as knowing a lot about.
He has some history with it too.
Right.
And I do think too that he understands his base. He understands a lot of his base is fed up with the same. So you looked at the campaign speeches about, you know, there's different ones about the NFL becoming soft, right? And so that resonates with his base. That resonates with people that are going to go out there and get out that vote for him.
Yeah.
He understands that he's leveraging that experience that he had within the sports world to that end.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what, you know, I think what you're getting at too.
Yeah. He understands how that correlates to himself or his goals, his aims. As far as myself, like reading through or studying or looking at these different things, kind of coming back to what we talked about briefly, and that's personal takeaway. You can have a great idea. You can have a good thing that you're going after. And if it's not done in the right way or at the right timing, it can fail. And that doesn't mean that it's the wrong move. That there's other factors, if that makes sense. So when we look at different things like, you know, like trying to own a team, the USFL moving, those types of things, you know, sometimes having, you know, some other input or taking other input can lead to making better decisions in good timing. I guess that's what I'm getting at is timing. A huge takeaway for me is timing is essential to the correctness of a decision.
We can look back and look at the lawsuit and say, hey, that night it'll have been a lot better to to pursue that loss in 1987, but we can say that because we know what happens in 1987. In 1984, they knew this contract was ending in 1987, the union contract, but they didn't know how that was going to end up. They didn't know what was going to happen. So it's easy to look back and play armchair quarterback. It's a lot more difficult to be there and to make those tough decisions that are right there, which kind of, it brings me up to my kind of my takeaway here. So Roosevelt says, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself on a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat." I think it's a great reminder of just get into the arena. Try, you know. It's timing is everything, but timing shouldn't be an excuse to not get into the arena. Get in the arena, fight for what you believe in. I think especially as we approach the November election, get out there and vote. Vote for the candidate that you think that is going to be the best for the U.S. Whatever area you're in your life, whether it be being a dad, being a husband, being a wife, being a mom, being an individual out there in the workforce, get into the arena and do something. Fight for what you believe in. Because even if you lose, at least you lost trying. At least you lost doing what you thought was right. And that's what I really respect about the guy John Bassett, is that he, as opposed to the other owners in there, as far as the kind of how they acquiesced to Donald Trump, John Bassett was in the arena fighting for what he believed in, fighting for what he thought was right. He lost, but you still have to give a lot of respect to John Bassett for his involvement in fighting for a cause he believed in.
Yeah, anything that's worthwhile, there will always be the possibility of failure. There will always be the possibility of losing in an endeavor, but that should never take away from taking on that endeavor, from taking on that work, like you said. Anything worthwhile is going to have that propensity to fail. But I love that I love that quote. As far as just get in the arena, do the necessary steps, do the work, you know, do the research, do the preparation, but try.
Yeah, be a man or woman to get in the arena. Yeah, what a fascinating story. What a fascinating look at Donald Trump.
That was good. It was good to kind of look through these things and a bunch of things I didn't know, and hopefully for you listening, you know, maybe some new information as well as things you might have heard about or heard around. But yeah, what a detailed look back as far as the different involvements of the man that now our president and forever in the histories of our nation, but in the history of football, his involvement with that. So, thank you for joining us on this episode. Be sure to check us out next time as we discuss one of the most memorable NBA finals in history. Is it possible for the best player on the planet to be an underdog? And are historically dominant teams sometimes just one groin punch away from losing a championship?
That's right. We'll be discussing the fascinating 2016 NBA finals between LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers versus the Golden State Warriors. Join us next time on Further Review. Hey, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and share it with someone. If you didn't enjoy it, let someone know. Either way, smash that share button.